This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The price of a college education has been skyrocketing in recent years, and along with it, student debt. The average student will leave his or her commencement ceremonies this year with $37,000 in student loan debt. That figure is higher than last year's, and next year's graduates will probably shoulder even more debt. Collectively, students and their parents are carrying a total debt of $1.25 trillion. Yikes. It's a staggering figure and one that can delay life plans for graduates for decades. And parents with plans to send multiple children through college face crushing debt if they're the ones signing the checks. So what can be done? What can you do? We spend the hour looking at that with two experts in the field. Heather Jarvis graduated from Duke University School of Law, cum laude, but she owed them $125,000. That's 30 years of payments at $1,200 a month. She's one of those folks who says she didn't know she couldn't afford such a good education until she got one. And today, Heather Jarvis is an attorney who has contributed to student debt relief policy for the House Education Committee in Washington and others in Congress, and works professionally to advance public service loan forgiveness. She specializes in student loan law and joins us from the studios of WHQR in Wilmington. Welcome to the program, Heather.
Thanks, Mike.
And in our studio is someone who may be very familiar to you. She's been on this program several times in the past. Lee Bierer is an independent college counselor and president of College Admissions Strategies. She also writes the Countdown to College columns, which have appeared in The Observer for the past 9 years and have just become nationally syndicated by Tribune News Service. Congratulations. Welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Heather, how can someone smart enough to get into Duke University Law School and then graduate cum laude, how can you do that and not know that you couldn't afford the price of it until you got out?
Well, you know, for me, Mike, I'm first generation college educated. So even though I come from a long line of weirdly intellectual folks who like to read a lot of books and listen to opera music, I haven't had anyone in my family attend college at all before. So my sister and I are the first generation. And so my family didn't have any money and didn't know anything about money. So what they taught me was that education is the key to success and to contributing to the society in which we live. And I believe that those things are true. What I didn't quite understand was how interest accrues over time and how difficult it can be to reduce a principal balance on a loan. In fact, my mother never even had a credit card, as I recall.
So when you got the bill for the $125,000 at the end of the as you left college, how big a surprise was it? I mean, surely you knew how much you were borrowing each year to go. Was it a big surprise to you?
I did. So I knew what I was. I knew that I was borrowing and what I was borrowing. I was borrowing only what I needed to pay for tuition and fees and some towards living expenses, because you're in fact not even permitted to work in your first year of law school. And what I didn't quite understand is what that would translate into in terms of a monthly payment, or how much I would pay over time. So, you know, if you borrow $125,000 and spread your payments out over 30 years, you can end up paying $250,000 by the time you're through. And my sort of perspective at that time, and honestly still to a certain degree, is that, you know, it's not only about money, or it's not all about money, that money is one thing that matters, but other things matter as well. And it was my goal, and has been my career, to, you know, help people who need particular kinds of assistance. And I've been able to make it work, but I, you know, I'm not exactly driving a sports car.
Well, I was going to say, have you paid it back yet?
So yeah, I have fully repaid my private student loans. Took me about 15 years to fully repay my private student loans. I still owe about $25,000 on my federal loans. I'm lucky in that when I borrowed, interest rates were quite low, so there isn't a whole lot of reason to pay them more aggressively than is required. And my eldest child is now a junior in college. I've got another one starting next year, And then the third one falling, running behind. So I have to pay for their school as much as I can as
so,
well.
So you are still paying back your loans, and now you're facing three kids going to college for whom you're going to at least make some partial payments. How common a problem is this, Lee?
Well, I think a lot of times families, particularly where there have been parents who didn't have a lot of choices and didn't have a lot of financial resources, but have been successful, want their kids to have all the choices in the world and don't want to put any restrictions on where they can look at colleges. And one of the first things I do with families is insist that they have a financial expectations conversation.
Why is this difficult for people? Because, you know, if you're making, I don't know, $50,000 a year, you're not going to buy a Maserati. You may love the Maserati, but you're not going to buy it because you probably can't get a loan for it anyway. But if you're not going to buy a $1 million home either. But parents shoot for the moon with regard to the college that their kid wants. If their heart is set on Harvard, they want to get their kid into Harvard, even though they can't really afford it. Why do they do that?
I think there's a couple of things at play. One is the potential return on investment. Okay, so that an education is unlike a car necessarily, that an education is viewed by families as an investment for future income. Right?
I think
that's one piece. In many cases, absolutely. It certainly depends on the career choice of the student, and there's a lot of things that I'm sure Heather can speak to about whether it's worth it to pay $65,000 a year to be a teacher versus going to a state school for a less than high-paying job.
Well, Heather, you went to Duke, and one of the things that I read about you is that the job that you dreamed of as an attorney after getting out of law school was one that paid $25,000 a year. And here you are with $125,000 in college loan debt. That's an example, I guess, of not understanding money.
Well, and also, Mike, an example of having other considerations be paramount for me.
Okay.
So I specifically wanted to and did represent criminal defendants who were impoverished. I had always had a kind of a bent towards standing up for people who are prosecuted with powers that are, you know, stronger than their own. And so I specifically was interested in Duke because of some of the clinical programs they offer that were and are specific to that university. So I did get what I paid for, and I very, very rarely regret choosing to attend law school at Duke, even though it cost me a lot more than some alternatives.
Could you have gotten the same information at a state school for less money or another school for less money? In other words, did you need a Duke University law degree to do what you wanted to do?
Not exactly, but to a degree. So they did have a particular clinical program that allowed me to start working with men on North Carolina's death row while I was a second year student. And I wouldn't have had that opportunity at every law school. I could have gotten an excellent education at cheaper schools, that's for sure. And I didn't fully consider the benefits of that route. But I also did get things from Duke that I couldn't have gotten at other schools that cost less money. But that's not true for everyone in every circumstance, you know. So I think that that Lee would agree that students and families need to consider schools that offer what they are looking for in an education, and also to consider price.
Yeah, but there are intangibles. When you go to a Duke or a Yale or a Harvard or a Princeton or any of the Ivy League schools or any of the major schools with big names, there are intangibles that you can't really put a price tag on. Maybe the education is identical in some cases to a state school, but you leave with a degree from that school and connections that you've made from that school. How big a dividend does that pay in life, Lee?
It's so variable. Okay, so I'm not a big believer in the prestige factor personally.
Okay.
I'm a much more practical person, and I encourage my families to be practical, because I think down the road, particularly if a student is unsure of what they want to major in, the idea of taking 4, sometimes 5 years, and just so you know, less than 50% of students graduate within 4 years. So the idea that this could be $50,000, $60,000, $65,000 a year for yet another year is frightening.
We're going to talk a lot about student loans and about how expensive they've become and how much debt people have, and we're going to talk about debt forgiveness. But one of the things I think we should talk about is something that you write about constantly, because mm-hmm. on the one hand, we hear about the rising massive amount of debt that people have. But on the other hand, we also hear stories of kids who go to school and it's pretty much free because they get grants, they get scholarships, they get this, they get that, and you help them find those instruments.
Yes, I do. And I think really important to note is that if the student is qualified to attend one of the more prestigious schools, those are the schools that are the best endowed. And so at Stanford and many of the Ivy League schools, if a family earns less than $125,000 a year, tuition is completely free, zero.
Wow.
So if you can make it, then you can afford it at those schools.
But then I would think you'd have to have a fairly high GPA or something about you that makes you special enough for them to want you to be there at $0.
Absolutely. But so does everyone else who actually gets in. When you're talking about a 4-5% acceptance rate, that 95%+ of kids are rejected, then absolutely those kids have to have something special.
As we go through this program, we want to hear from you and we want to hear your questions, because we know a lot of people have questions about the debt they've already accumulated and or about the debt they may accumulate if they go to college or send their kid to college. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or, of course, reach us through Facebook or Twitter. Is a college degree worth the massive amount of debt that people accumulate to get it? I mean, if you
yes,
want, it is.
Absolutely, it is, Mike. I mean, the statistics are entirely clear that it is that people without college degrees struggle much more financially than those with them.
But if you're making more money as a result of having to get having gotten a college degree, but you're also paying off a mountain of debt that will take you 35 years to pay off, is it a wash?
No. You're better off with a college degree and debt than with no college degree and no debt. What really makes people struggle, and this happens to many, many people, are those who attend school, borrow money to pay for the education, but for whatever reason do not complete their education. And that happens to a lot of folks. And if you have student debt and no credential, that's when it gets really
wow.
tricky.
You were nodding in recognition.
Absolutely.
Of that.
You know, and I think particularly it obviously depends on the amount that's borrowed and the amount of accumulated debt at the end, but also the for-profit institutions that have such a pretty miserable graduation rate, there's an even higher correlation of students who borrow to attend those schools. And so I think that that's something to revisit.
And those students are also borrowing more risky and expensive loans.
When we talk about for-profit colleges, very quickly, 10 seconds, who are we talking about?
University of Phoenix.
The ones that advertise on television.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more about student debt and the price of a college education and how to manage all of this in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Healthy Home Market, announcing Plaza Patio parties with food, live music, and beer at their Plaza Midwood location Friday, May 20th from 5 to 8 p.m. Details available at healthyhomemkt.com. And the North Carolina Zoo. Attendees will experience the wild side at the Run Wild 5K on June 4th at the North Carolina Zoo in Asheboro. Information at nczoo.org. On the Friday News Roundup, HB2 continues to dominate the news, moving this week into the national arena with the state suing the feds and the feds suing the state. City budget discussions continue with apartment garbage collection still up in the air. The CMS board is requesting $23 million from the county, and they say that really isn't enough. And one of our own, Stephen Curry, is the NBA's MVP. again. He plays for the wrong team. Those stories and more tomorrow at 9 on this program.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, Facebook denies there's political bias in its lists of top trending news stories. But allegations raise concerns about the power of Facebook, Twitter, and other social media companies to influence political discourse. New trends in how news is delivered and calls for greater transparency.
The Ian Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about student debt and the price of a college education and the mounting amount of student loan debt that's out there, $1.25 trillion collectively. It's an enormous amount. Heather Jarvis is with us, a student debt expert and attorney specializing in student loans. She joins us from studios in Wilmington. And Lee Bierer is in our studio, president of College Admission Strategies and the columnist who writes the Countdown to College column that appears in the Observer and newspapers around the country, thanks to the Tribune syndicate. According to Bankrate.com, the general rule of thumb for student loan borrowing is that the total amount of student debt should not exceed the borrower's anticipated annual salary for the first year out of school. If you agree with that, why is that realistic, and how do you know how much you're going to make in that first year out of school?
I think most students who have an idea of what they might want to do, and that's probably the biggest issue, is that so many students, understandably, at 17, 18 years old, don't know what they want to do, right? But those who do, if you want to be a teacher, I think you can have a pretty accurate assessment of what your first year income is going to be. And if you're thinking about down the road of heading to graduate school, which is a whole different wrinkle in this discussion, because how much debt do you want to have from undergraduate if you're planning on going to graduate school? So an engineer, as an example, would have a much larger first year income, and so that the debt would be less.
Would it be more? Would it be smarter to go to a state school or a less expensive school for your undergraduate degree and then shoot for the moon on your graduate degree?
That's always what almost always what I advocate. Okay, so for families where finances are a discussion, and hard to believe, but there are actually some families who can look at a bill of $250,000 for an undergraduate degree and not wince. But for families where they need to consider financial expectations, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful option, because, you know, down the road, it's the last, is just like when you're going for a new job, it's the last job you had. So your last bit of schooling is going to be more influential in your job search.
Another, and I guess maybe the same thing applies here, because another strategy that people have been using more and more is going to community college for the first several years of college and then transferring to a four-year school for the last couple of years. Is that a
I think that's
good way
a wonderful strategy for families that need to do that. For many families, they have put aside some money for the child, and they can often afford an in-state tuition. So if they can go to in-state tuition without accumulating any debt, then they can save money for graduate school.
College debt has been skyrocketing. As we've said, it's going up far faster than the rate of inflation. And I guess we should talk about why. It's going up. The amount of debt is going up because the cost to go to school is going up. What is driving that, Heather?
Well, there are a number of factors that are driving the increase in the price of education, including faculty salaries, but also healthcare costs for the employees of the university, as well as the costs of energy have gone up for those institutions, just like for everyone else.
But I don't think my electric bill or my water bill or my medical bills have increased by 53% in the last 10 years. And that's what college has increased by, 53%
right,
on average. And it's up 61% for in-state schools.
So a big reason for that is a decreased investment at the state level and the government level. So tuition is more a source of revenue for institutions than it once was. We used to have greater investment by states directly in the universities so that the costs were not passed to students and families by way of tuition and fees.
And this is happening in both Democratic and Republican-controlled states, or just primarily Republican-controlled states?
It's happening in a lot of places because revenue is down at the state level as a result of various policies, including those, you know, passed by political parties, but also because of the recession and the fact that people are earning less and paying less in taxes because of their lack of income.
Who more often carries this immense student loan debt? Is it the students themselves or is it their parents?
It's very often the students directly, although parents are also borrowing more and more. We also see a disproportionate impact of student debt on low-income and minority families, Black and Latino families, partly because those families are less likely to have access to other sources of wealth, and because policies tend to favor those who are already doing fairly well. So, for example, there are tax benefits that can assist with education costs, and those are of more value to families who already have money than they are to lower-income families.
Now, I left college in the Pleistocene age with student loan debt because I paid my way through, and it seemed crushing to me at the time, although I think my monthly payment was way less than $500 a month. It was probably closer to $100, $120, $130, $150 a month. I don't know. It wasn't all that long ago. That seemed manageable to me. And in fact, I did pay it off in relative short order because it was at a low interest rate. What are the common interest rates today on college loans? Do you know? Helen?
It depends on which loan you're talking about. So the interest rates are different for undergraduate borrowers that borrow directly as students and different for their parents within the federal system. They're also different for graduate and professional borrowers. And private student loans are nearly always more expensive than federal student loans. Federal student loans have fixed interest rates that are set by Congress. The current scheme sets interest rates for the upcoming academic year each spring. So presently, rates, depending on the loan and depending on the borrower, are right around 6%.
You can get a home mortgage for 3, 3.5.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm all for charging lower interest rates for student borrowers. I absolutely believe that that would be an excellent policy for the federal government to embrace. But I will say that I think it's a little bit false to compare it to, for example, mortgage interest rates, because we're talking about unsecured debt. So one of the reasons you can get a mortgage at a good rate is because the bank can always come and take back the house. Same with an auto loan. When it comes to student loans, there's no underwriting happening at the federal level. So you are permitted to borrow without regard for your ability to repay. And many people who are in school are either not working full time or not working at all, or may not have perfect credit. So they truly couldn't go to the private market and find a far better interest rate. A few people could, but many people could not. And so federal student loans really are subsidized in terms of their interest rates for many people.
When you,
they could do better, in my view.
When you leave college with debt, and I think you said that you left with a $1,200 a month for 30 years kind of debt. When you do that, there's obviously an impact on you as the individual and what you can do financially going forward. Can you buy a house? Can you buy a car? It depends on so many different things. It locks you into certain kinds of jobs that you may not like, but you got to have the money to pay off the debt. What is the impact, though, on society? When you add this up to $1.25 trillion, what is that doing to the economy?
I think there has been a lot of studies done about this, about the students are delaying marriage. They're delaying home purchases. They're, as you said, they're taking jobs that they may not have wanted necessarily to take or were prepared or educated to take because they need to take a more lucrative position that they may not want as well. So there are a variety of economic impacts to society at large.
So I'm sorry. Go ahead, Heather.
I was going to say, in addition to the things that Lee mentioned, we also know that that debt has a psychological burden on people and can affect their decision making in terms of entrepreneurial activities, you know, starting their own business. And it also makes it harder for people to save for their own retirement as well as for their children's college education.
So are we being penny wise and pound foolish by not lowering interest rates, but by not finding ways to keep the costs of college down? Because you extrapolate this out to society at large, and we're suppressing parts of the economy here.
And it really is, Mike. You're absolutely right. It is vital that we have an educated workforce. It is a public good that we have people who receive education and who are then able to do highly skilled, you know, sorts of employment that requires that kind of education. If we don't have people with those credentials, we can't succeed as a group.
So in one of your columns, Lee, you wrote that you are terrified when you meet with parents who are so afraid of disappointing their children that they will do whatever they need to do to make that college experience happen for them. What do you tell them?
I caution them to be more realistic about what the accumulated debt is going to be when the student graduates and what the potential income for that student is going to be and how that's going to impact their family and that student and to carry that forward.
And you also say, because you write a lot about what to look for in a college,
right,
how to find the right college, how to figure out whether that college is going to fit your students' needs, their personality, whether they're going to be comfortable on campus, whether it satisfies their academic or their athletic needs. But you also say the college also needs to be a good financial fit.
Right.
Where would that be on your list of priorities?
So I talk about the trifecta of fit, which we always, as you mentioned, we talk about the academic fit, a place where they're going to be challenged but not overwhelmed academically, a social fit where they're going to look around and sort of feel good and the atmosphere and the social environment is something they want, whether it's sports or Greek life or the town or the distance from home, a variety of factors. For social fit. And then very importantly, right up there with the other two is the financial fit for the family.
In North Carolina, at least, there has been a philosophy. I guess it's a change, a philosophy change, at least at the government level. I know that Governor McCrory has talked about the importance of providing educations for which there are jobs after graduation. In other words, you should go to school so you can get a good job. Is that valid? Philosophy majors are not necessarily going to get a good job in the field of philosophy.
No.
Hey, I have a good job, Mike, and I was a philosophy major.
Okay.
And I was going to say, yeah, I was going to say that apparently med school and law school love, graduate schools love philosophy majors because they know how to think.
They know how to think.
They know how to think.
Well, I picked the wrong subject.
Okay,
English,
you did. But, okay.
History.
Same thing, though, honestly. You know, if you talk to graduate schools, they don't, med school don't necessarily want kids who majored in biology. You need to take the requirements, the required courses, but they'd rather have you have a little diversity in their student body and not have everybody be pre-med majors.
Okay. We've been hearing from people as we've been talking, so let me share with some of their comments with you. Eric emails, I graduated from a state law school with around $175,000 in student loan debt. The most frustrating part of my situation is the interest rate. I pay almost 7% interest on my non-dischargeable federal student loan debt, a higher rate than one of my credit cards and a much higher rate than that given to the banks during the bailout. The monthly interest payments on my student loans are higher than my mortgage. Mm-hmm. The federal government makes almost $30 billion a year in revenue by charging excessive interest on student loans. Why won't Congress agree to let students refinance student loans at lower rates? The government is making money on all of this.
Yes, and what the government is doing with the money that it's making on student loans in part is to redistribute it to other students. They fund Pell Grants and the like. It particularly graduate and professional borrowers like the person who emailed us and myself – pay higher interest rates that are used as part of the funding for the Department of Education. And it's funny, you know, the point specifically about what it costs the government to loan and the revenue that's generated is one that Elizabeth Warren and Donald Trump have had some agreement about, that the government shouldn't be making money on student loans.
Let's talk about that. Bernie Sanders advocates a free college education at state schools, I believe. Is that feasible?
I'm not sure it's feasible. I personally don't support that. I'm a huge proponent that students should have some skin in the game. And I think that when you – I think it devalues the education. If it's free
– it's worthless.
It doesn't have the same value.
You give people free tickets to an event and they don't show up because they didn't put $100 in there for the tickets. Hillary Clinton has put forth some specific ideas about reducing the cost of education and borrowing. Donald Trump hasn't said much because he hasn't really said much about a lot of things. But as you point out, Heather, he does agree with liberal center Senator Elizabeth Warren that the government shouldn't be profiting from student loans. So if the government stopped profiting on student loans, what would be the outcome of that? Would fewer students have an opportunity to get loan money or get educations? Because, as you say, they're using the profits from those loans to help other people.
Well, the outcome could be whatever Congress is willing to make it. It would require additional investment of government funds in order to support access to education. So I think there are a lot of ways to get where we need to be, where everyone can access affordable education. We need to have an educated workforce, and it is we need people who come from families of lesser means, who are not extraordinarily wealthy, to also be able to access education. Whether we do that by making college free, as Senator Sanders has proposed, or making it possible without debt, as Secretary Clinton has proposed, we would still get to the same place. But in any event, it requires a commitment on the part of society to help finance those costs up front. And this whole system of debt-based access was sort of accidental. You know, student loans were not initially created as like the way for people to pay for education. They were going to be, you know, a help for, you know, returning GIs to access education. And we've seen the policy sort of take on its own life over the years and become really the primary means of accessing education. And that's not the only way you could do it. You can have scholarships, you can have grants, you can have at least some skin in the game for students and families, but also for the educational institutions themselves to demonstrate that they are educating people properly.
And in fact, you can have a combination of all three. You can get grants and scholarships and still have a student loan to help pay for it all. Heather Jarvis is with us from Wilmington. She's a student debt expert and an attorney specializing in student loans. Lee Beer is also here, president of College Admissions Strategies and the writer of the Countdown to College syndicated column. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, located at Brookdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wines from around the world, live local music, and craft beer on tap. Relax, uncork, unwind. The Corkscrew, details at thecorkscrew.com. And Bojangles, featuring the smoked sausage biscuit, hickory smoked sausage, on a made-from-scratch buttermilk biscuit, available all day at area Bojangles. Facebook denies there's political bias in its lists of top trending news stories, but the allegations raise concerns about the power of Facebook and Twitter and other social media companies to influence political discourse. So, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, new trends and how news is curated and calls for greater transparency. That's the topic on the Diane Rehm Show, and we are coming right back moments from now.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Well, it's being called the largest wildfire evacuation in Alberta history.
It's your community. we help you understand it.
Violent crime and murders were up substantially last year. CMPD Chief Kerr Putney says the city needs more cops to keep up with a booming population.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about college debt and college loans and how to afford college and how to pay off those debts, and maybe some secrets in there as well. Heather Jarvis is an attorney specializing in that, and Lee Bierer is with us, the Countdown to College columnist. You have come to be an expert, Heather, in all of this because of your own experience and a desire, as you said earlier in this program, to help others not fall into the same trap you found yourself in upon graduation. And you've said that the rules around student loan programs are so convoluted that it's difficult for even educated people to navigate. Is there less transparency in the student loan market than there is in the home mortgage loan market?
I would say they're quite similar. So for those of us who've reviewed a mortgage or signed a mortgage, there are many papers of fine print and incorporating various statutes and regulations. And student loans are similarly convoluted. The system is very tricky to navigate, primarily because it's created by the Higher Education Act of 1965 plus 50 years worth of amendments to that legislation and tens of thousands of pages of regulatory guidelines. And some of the rules have improved significantly over the last, say, decade in ways that are very helpful for student loan borrowers, except that they're so difficult to understand and access that they're not able to really fulfill the promise. And an example of that are these income-driven repayment options that are now available for federal student loans. So everyone should be able to afford their monthly payments on their federal student loans by choosing a payment plan that sets their payment amount based on their income.
Can you change that as your income changes?
Yes. In fact, it changes annually or more often if the borrower requests.
But aren't you accruing if your income goes down for some reason, maybe you lose your job for 6 months and you can adjust your payment down, are you still accruing interest at the same rate?
You are. So it does nothing to solve the problem of high interest rates. That's correct. But it does keep payments affordable to keep people out of delinquency or default. And the federal government has extraordinary collection powers and can do things like garnish people's wages without a court order, seize tax refunds and other federal benefits. And so keeping current on federal loans is vital to success for individuals. But you're certainly right. If you pay minimum payments on your loans, you don't get ahead of the curve.
One of the things that you have worked on over the years is contributing to student debt relief. Now, if an educated person furthers their education by getting loans to do so, why should they be forgiven? Because an uneducated person might go out on a $12,000 a year salary and buy a big screen television and a Cadillac because they want to, and they're not going to be forgiven.
Well, what we need are safety nets for people who run into difficulties through no fault of their own. So the reason that people struggle or declare bankruptcy, for example, are typically because they become ill and can't work, or they're laid off from employment. And student loans need to be like other forms of credit, where we recognize that people have an obligation to repay and a responsibility to do so, but that also have a safety net in the event that something goes terribly wrong, because we don't want to saddle people with wrecked credit and no access to commerce forever just because, you know, they've been unlucky enough to have an occurrence.
Lee
Bierer,
how much of this problem that we're talking about today, student debt and the cost of college, how much of it could be alleviated by starting a college savings program early?
obviously a lot, right? Okay, so the question is, I think most people have really good intentions, and I think we'll set one up, and I think it's really the maintenance of it that happens. So you have great intentions in the beginning, and then it don't necessarily follow through.
How do you know when to start, particularly if you're a young couple, you have no children? But you start funding your children's college education before you have any children. How can you? First of all, can you do that legally and get some of the breaks that come along with it if you haven't got kids yet? Can you? Are there breaks if you have children? You can save in a college fund,
right?
Like you save in an IRA.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have children, can you do that?
I honestly don't know. I don't know if Heather knows that.
No, I think for the 529 plans, you have to have a designated beneficiary.
So how do you know how much to put into that fund and so in order to fund what you want to accomplish at the end of the line? How do you know?
I think you need to have – I think you need to budget. I mean, it pretty straightforward stuff. I think you need to understand what your
– But if the cost of college education has risen 61% in the last 10 years, do you just say, okay, I'm going to need – My child is going to college in 18 years, so I'm going to need 124% more money now than I need now. So that's what I got to save for. That's my target.
I think you want. I think if financiers are going to be an issue, then I think you want to say, look, I'm going to be practical and I'm going to save so that I can comfortably put my child through a state institution. And if by some magical something happens and you can afford to put in more, but I mean, I think the you can assume that the state institutions will remain reasonably priced.
When you go to the admissions office, they want to know everything about your finances. They want to know how much money you make, what your net worth is, et cetera. And that's fair because they're maybe going to give you a scholarship or some student loan assistance or student aid assistance. If you've put money – if you've been responsible and you've put money into a college fund, do they say, well, you don't need the scholarship because you've got this money? Are you hurting yourself?
Well, families need to fill out two basic forms. One is the FAFSA, which is the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, and that's required by virtually every college. And then a variety of private institutions also request something called the profile. And they're different forms, and they're not nearly as complicated or as intimidating as people think they are. And the product of the FAFSA is something called the EFC, which is the Expected Family Contribution. And that is the basic number that the colleges, the admissions and financial aid office, believe you can afford. You may not agree with it, but it's what they have determined you can afford. And then your aid is based on that EFC. So if the EFC is $20,000 and the college costs $40,000, then you have a gap in their eyes of $20,000. You may not even think you can afford the $20,000, but that's what they've determined.
But if you have put money aside in the college fund, that is figured into what you can afford, correct?
Yes. It is, and there's a differential between what's in a child's name and what's in the parent's name.
So how should you open these college funds, in the child's name or in your name?
Well, it is – there's a higher rate for anything that's in the student's name. So there is some opportunity to –
A higher rate of what? I'm sorry.
A higher rate that is used in the calculations for what your EFC is.
Okay. Let me share some more emails. Amy writes, I'm the first person on either side of my family to go to college, and student loans were something I had to take on to make it through 4 years. I graduated in 2005, and I was able to find a job using my degree, but when the economy took the downturn, I lost my job. I could not find another job using my degree, so I went to a trade school. I am in the same field, and I'm making more money now than others with the same degree that I have doing the job that I used to do. The issue in my option is that we are a society that tells ourselves that a college degree is required, and if you don't have it, you won't be successful. Trade school used to be a viable option to make a decent living. Well, now the society we live in says that isn't good enough. You think a college degree is required to make $60,000 a year? Call a plumber or an electrician on a Saturday. What about that?
I think that's a really interesting comment. I don't believe that every single high school student has to go to a four-year college. And I think that that's that there's a bit of a cultural sense that's a requirement. And I think that is misleading and often ends up with kids who have that unfortunate circumstance where they may start school, borrow money, and not graduate.
Yeah, but there is this cultural bias. Where'd you go to college? Oh, you didn't?
Mm-hmm.
That's all that has to be said. Oh, you
mm-hmm.
didn't? So do we have to get over that?
I think so.
Yeah, and I think it's an excellent point. We certainly need people who are skilled in trades, as well as people who are educated with four-year and higher degrees. We need a variety of people doing a variety of different jobs, and so we need a variety of different kinds of affordable education.
Mm-hmm.
And there are fewer jobs that pay well for people without educations than there once were. You know, so there aren't the kind of jobs in industry that used to be excellent jobs. And we do see our economy moving more towards higher skilled, higher tech, science and math based economy. And so while I agree that not everyone should go to college, that there are lots of other worthwhile and important roles to play, we do also need to figure out how to make, you know, college and even graduate and professional school affordable for those people who take that route.
Chris emails, there is no right to a college experience. Americans have a problem admitting when they can't afford something. You still get a quality, affordable education from a state school by either commuting or getting an online degree. If you can afford to go to an expensive school and stay on campus, great. Otherwise, stay at home a few more years and either commute or get an online degree and work a job at the same time if you have to. Now, that's what I did. I was an out-of-state student.
You can't do it like you used to.
Well, why not?
Mike,
because
you
say that kids today are not as, I'm trying to think of the word that you used, able to get a job as boomers were while they were in college. Why?
People are being paid about the same that they were paid when you were in school, but that money doesn't go nearly as far because their housing expenses and food expenses and energy expenses are all far higher than they used to be. And notably for this conversation, their tuition is much, much, much higher than it used to be. So the amount of hours a person would have to work to pay their way through school is wildly different than it was when the previous generation was in school.
So working at McDonald's isn't going to work for you.
It's much, much tougher. And even getting those jobs at McDonald's, there are real grown-ups with families to support in those positions. And let's not forget that we think of college students as, you know, 18-year-old kids who have a family home. In fact, the non-traditional student is the majority of students, people who are adults who do have responsibilities, financial and otherwise, who are returning to school or entering school at other points in life. It's not just a, you know, kid from a family that we're talking about here.
Aaron on Facebook says, first things first, wipe all debt above $15,000 clean, everyone's. If the government can bail out the banks, they can write off 90% of the debt owed. Next, we are going to have to stop doling out money. This is the reason tuition is so high. It's basic economics. Free money causes inflation. But wouldn't wiping out the debt above $15,000 be free money? I mean, you owe that money. Heather, you say that waiting to pay back your loans used to be a good strategy. Waiting how long, and is that not true anymore?
Well, sometimes we would take advantage of something called a forbearance or a deferment to postpone the requirement to make payments. And so that used to be the best strategy, the only option for people who were between jobs or still looking for work or unable to afford their full payment. Now we have better options that are usually more beneficial. And these are these income-driven repayment plans. There are many to choose from, and they set affordable payments, which at least keeps people moving forward on their loans without falling into any sort of delinquency, and does help to minimize the ability for the interest to continue to balloon over time, as would be the case with the more sort of traditional or old-fashioned route of choosing the forbearance and postponing payments altogether.
You also say that income-based repayment options are woefully underused. Is that because people don't know about them?
Yes, it's partly because people don't know about them, and partly because the companies that are hired to administer the loan programs have only recently started advising people about the options in a way that's appropriate. And also because the system itself is pretty cumbersome and it can be difficult to access it. But it could go a long way letting people know that there are these options for affordable payments. You don't have to and shouldn't just walk away from your federal student loans. That has terrible consequences, and these affordable options are available for people.
Some experts believe that whatever your loan amount is, it should be something you can afford to pay back in 10 years. If the average student is leaving college today with $37,000 in debt, that means some are leaving with quite a bit more than $37,000 in debt. Can you pay back $37,000 comfortably over 10 years?
I think it depends.
Depends on how much you're making,
right? Depends on how much you're making, where you live. Are you going to go back and live in your parents' basement? Are you going to do you want a cell phone? You know, doing your own budget and making sure that it's viable.
And that's something you should be doing when you go to college, doing your own budget to figure out how much you can really afford to spend for room and board and extras and things like that. Lee Bierer is president of College Admission Strategies, independent college counselor, and the writer of the Countdown to College syndicated column. Heather Jarvis, a student debt expert and an attorney specializing in student loans. Thank you both for the hour.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.